Hamas warns Israel of massive missile strikes if Tel Aviv carries out its threats to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders. India's threat to deport thousands of Rohingyas creates panic among the Muslim refugees. Coming up, Press Today's report from a refugee camp near New Delhi. China steps up efforts to contain a COVID outbreak in Beijing by mass testing millions of residents. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Top story, Palestinian resistance group Hamas issuing a strong-worded warning to the Tel Aviv regime on plans to target its leaders. The movement says it will burn the Israeli-occupied cities to the ground with massive missile strikes if Tel Aviv carries out its threats to assassinate the group's leaders. Hamas says it won't remain indifferent to threats and that Tel Aviv will pay the price for any such foolish act. Also, Palestinians in the city of Khan Yunus have rallied to denounce the regime's threats to assassinate Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. Israeli authorities call for the assassination of top Hamas officials after a Palestinian stab and attack left three people dead in the city of Eilat 3 days ago. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon says that the Islamic Jihad movement has also pledged to stand by Hamas and striking Israeli cities if the regime moves to assassinate Hamas leaders.
Senior Islamic Jihad official Khaled al-Batsh said that even before the Hamas's military wing fires rockets towards the Israeli regime, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad will even fire rockets towards the Israeli regime before those of Hamas, expressing solidarity of all Palestinian resistance groups with Yahya as Sinwar. Last year, during the month of May, during the Israeli war in May, Israeli warplanes bombed the Sinwar's house in Khan Yunis, but he wasn't there, although his house was completely destroyed during that 11-day war.
The tensions continue to surge in Israeli-occupied territories, Tel Aviv now saying it's arrested two Palestinians who it claims killed three Israelis in an attack 4 days ago. The two were caught near the city of Eilat, where the stab and attack took place. They reportedly from the Jenin area of the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces launched a massive manhunt and security crackdown following the incident. They've also extended a closure on crossings with the West Bank and the Gaza Strip until Monday. The attack was the latest in a string of deadly operations targeting Israelis. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation, saying they are the result of Israeli raids and brutality, particularly at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds. In other news, the European Union's foreign policy chief says that he's looking for what he's calling a middle way to end the deadlock in the talks for the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. In an interview with the Financial Times, Josep Borrell said that the EU is making a last-ditch effort to address the U.S. sanctions on Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. His interview was published ahead of EU negotiator Enrique Mora's visit to Tehran, planned for Tuesday. The talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA have stalled for weeks. Tehran says a sustainable deal in the Vienna talks hinges on a pragmatic decision by the U.S. to make up for its past mistakes. The Islamic Republic demands that the U.S. remove all sanctions and provide guarantees it won't quit the deal again. Panic engulfing Rohingya refugee camps across India as the South Asian nation intends to deport thousands of refugees amid calls for a concrete refugee policy. As our correspondent reports from India, many are living in hiding in many parts of India, fearing detention and separation from their families. Here's the report.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations.
We have come here only to save our life. During earlier years, it was only about the basic things to survive. But now, it's becoming more challenging and harder day by day. since we hear from news that we'll be deported to Myanmar. We can't sleep at night, fearing detention, deportation, and separation from families. They want to send us back to Dai, where our left-out community is being silently tortured and killed.
This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy since the country has no refugee law. They urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Chinese officials once again mass testing millions of residents for COVID across several districts of capital Beijing. This is part of a campaign to stamp out a small outbreak before it turns into a Shanghai-type crisis. The daily caseload in the capital is in the dozens, and this has led officials to close gyms and entertainment centers and many public transport routes. Still, the measures are far more lenient than the economically damaging lockdown, which has almost confined people to their homes in Shanghai. Their daily infections were in the tens of thousands at their peak in April, but the city saw its daily cases fall for the ninth day on Sunday. Time now for the News Review program. The Nationalist Party Sinn Féin is celebrating a historic first-ever win in the Northern Ireland Assembly election. It's setting in motion a process that could lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom and reunification with the Republic of Ireland.
Those of us that are for unification will make that case. I encourage those that actually don't have that perspective at this moment in time to also enter into the conversation. Let's have a healthy debate about what our future looks like, something that's better for each and every one of us, where we all have a valued place in our society. So I really encourage that conversation. We have made an ask of the Irish government consistently that they must now create the conditions for a conversation around constitutional change. That has always been our perspective, and that will be my perspective tomorrow as well. Thank you.
O'Neill described the election win as a defining moment, saying that Northern Ireland was entering a new era. The Republican Party has so far secured 23 seats of the 90-seat legislature, with O'Neill set to claim the role of First Minister. The rival pro-UK Democratic Unionist Party has already conceded defeat. A Unionist Party has been the largest in the government since Northern Ireland was formed in 1921. The ultimate goal of Sinn Féin is for Northern Ireland to leave the UK and become one country with the Republic of Ireland. Meanwhile, in the UK's local elections, embattled Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has lost control of key councils, including in London. The Tories suffered an overall loss of almost 400 councillors in the vote. Pro-independence sentiments also remained strong in Scotland, where the Scottish National Party again finished as the biggest winner in council elections. So what's going on in the UK? Let's bring in a couple of guests from the UK, our own Amina Teller, our London bureau. Also, Daniel Morrison, former Sinn Féin publicity director, joining us from Belfast. Good to see you both. Okay, now, beginning with Amina. So we see what's happening in Scotland and Ireland, and now also we have, in the UK, we have the Tories losing. Tell us about what's going on there and how far Boris Johnson is to blame for this.
Well, I think it would have been a very bad day for Conservative ministers waking up this morning, because not only are they dealing with the inevitable fallout from the situation in the north of Ireland, but they'll also be looking around places like London, where they would have lost key Conservative seats. I mean, just up the road from me in Barnet, it was an overwhelmingly Conservative enclave, and that's now shifted over to Labour, with a lot of smaller parties also picking up votes there. And I think this gives, if you're looking for what the political arch is and what the trajectory is, I think it's easy and clear to see that people are tired of the status quo. They've tried it, whether it be unionism in the north of Ireland, whether it be conservatism in some parts of the United Kingdom, or even Labour to some respects. People want to try an alternative voice. They're like, we've given these guys an opportunity to do right by us. So far, that has not really borne fruits for us. Let's hear what these other parties and these other groups have to say. And I think if we look from the situation happening on the island of Ireland all the way down to just the very south in London where I am, I think there is time for a new perspective and a new voice. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on what side of the political divide you're on, it's that old school conservatism that's losing it.
Okay. Now, Daniel Morrison, let us know more about the factors that have actually contributed to and led to this historic win by Sinn Féin.
Well, there are many factors. First of all, our Republican objective is to reverse historical injustice, where our nation was partitioned at the point of a gun by the likes of Churchill and Lloyd George in 1921. Our country was partitioned up until then. It was one unit, but totally occupied by British colonialism, British imperialism. And in 1921, the northern part of our country, which held a lot of pro-British supporters, known as the Unionists, they were given power. We were a minority. We were a majority before partition, and then we ended up in a minority in this artificial state, which is called Northern Ireland. And the history of that state was one of oppression, where we were treated as second-class citizens, where we didn't have equal votes. The franchise was denied us in many respects at local government level. When we protested for civil rights, we were beaten into the ground. Thousands of us were burnt out of our homes, and the British Army reoccupied the north. And then ensued a guerrilla warfare for 25, 30 years fought by the IRA against the British state. And as a result of a military stalemate arising in the 1990s, the IRA ceasefired. The British Army admitted it couldn't defeat the IRA, and Republicans concentrated all of their efforts, including ex-prisoners, ex-hunger strikers, ex-IRA volunteers, into the party Sinn Féin, which is one of the oldest parties in Ireland. And in this election, Sinn Féin topped the poll, is coming out with 27 seats to the second unionist party, the second party, Democratic Unionist Party, which is on 25 seats, although their vote went down by 6%. So we have a situation today where we want to reverse this historic injustice, but at the same time, we're mindful and pragmatic enough to know that we must also service the constituents, the people here who are suffering greatly as a result of the cost of living. There are other repercussions from with Boris Johnson's completely irresponsible Brexit, which was aimed at helping his friend and the wealthiest friends in Britain. We were pulled out of the European Union against our will, but as a result of lobbying and to prevent a return of a hard border between the north and south of Ireland, we were able to exact a protocol which basically, for all intents and purposes, kept the north of Ireland inside the customs union in the single market.
Now, I mean, I want to ask you about how you would feel when you hear the news that this is happening in Ireland, and then also in Scotland, we have again the Scottish National Party winning, so we can be expecting this independence move to push there. So as a Briton, how would you feel? And when you talk to people in the street, how do they feel about this separation that's unlikely? that's
well,
likely.
I've had good fortune to visit these places in my capacity as a correspondent for this channel quite frequently. And I think the sense that you're getting from people is that Westminster isn't offering solutions anymore. They're not even making the case for these solutions anymore. The campaign seems to be a negative one. Leave us and this is what will happen to you. Well, if you're somebody who's struggling with the cost of your heating bill, or you've seen some of your opportunities kind of go up in smoke, either because of the European situation that Britain is no longer a real player in, or even just the day-to-day way in which you live your lives, if Westminster and that government are not offering you a palatable and positive solution, then I think there are a lot of individuals who I've spoken to, from school teachers to ministers, who say, let's try something else. And I think it's the inability of Westminster to come up with a really positive case for remaining inside a controlled, an era controlled by Westminster and Parliament down here, which is why you're seeing these shifts, the one towards reunification in Ireland, the one towards independence in Scotland. There's even a thriving movement and a growing movement for independence in Wales. So one of your viewers there mentioned the disunited kingdom of just England and Wales. It might not even be Wales left. So right. England is looking as if, you know, slowly, 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 it might be just shaking off some of those other countries. And I'm afraid it's with great irony here that it would be a conservative, a successive number of conservative governments who would have been responsible thoroughly and utterly for the breakup of the United Kingdom. I find it hard to see how there's not a sense of inevitability about this.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments. I'm Anna Taylor from London, and Daniel Morris from Belfast. That's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable, unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. Countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and will prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the US, and in the end, the US won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the US, as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well. And if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keeps the government strong, keeps the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Buxong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued Gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued Gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the U.S. dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the U.K. And then the U.S., reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the US would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, then I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the US be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the UK. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the US. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the US, the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back. although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline, and as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again here next time on Aperture. If you have questions and comments you'd like to share with us, just email or visit our Facebook or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
Stories from the Palms. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear listeners of this program, Lantern, thank you very much for joining us. The title of today's story in this part is The Most Important Body Part. My mother used to ask me which was the most important part of the body. Through the years, I would take a guess at what I thought was the correct answer. When I was younger, I thought sound was very important to us as humans, so I said, "My ears, Mommy." She said, "No, many people are deaf, but you keep thinking about it, and I will ask you again soon." Several years passed before she asked me again. Since making my first attempt, I had contemplated the correct answer, so this time I told her, "Mommy, sight is very important to everybody, so it must be our eyes." She looked at me and told me, "You're learning fast, but the answer is not correct because there are many people who are blind." Stumped again. I continued my quest for knowledge, and over the year, Mother asked me a couple more times, and always her answer was, "No, but you are getting smarter every year, my child." Then last year, my grandpa died. Everybody was hurt. Everybody was crying. Even my father cried. I remember that especially because it was only the second time I saw him cry. My mom looked at me when it was our turn to say our final goodbye to Grandpa. She asked me, "Do you know the most important body part yet, my dear?" I was shocked when she asked me this now. I always thought this was a game between her and me. She saw the confusion on my face and told me, "This question is very important. It shows that you have really lived in your life for every body part you gave me in the past. In the past, I have told you that you were wrong and I have given you an example why. But today is the day you need to learn this important lesson." She looked down at me as only a mother can. I saw her eyes well up with tears. She said, "My dear, the most important body part is your shoulder." I asked, "Is it because it holds up my head?" She replied, "No, it is because it can hold the head of a friend or a loved one when they cry. Everybody needs a shoulder to cry on sometime in life, my dear. I only hope that you have enough love and friends, that you will always have a shoulder to cry on when you need it." Then and there, I knew the most important body part is not a selfish one. It is sympathetic to the pain of others.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binastain. In this episode, we are going to talk about certain aspects of sympathy or showing sympathy to other people. In the words and deeds of the first infallible Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, Amir al-Mu'mini Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, we find that in his instructions to Malik ibn al-Harith al-Ashtar al-Nakhai, who was going to be his representative and the governor of Egypt. Of course, when we say Egypt in that time meant a greater part of northern Africa. At that time, we find that Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam recommended Malik al-Ashtar regarding being attentive to the rights of other people, to the rights of widows, to the rights of orphans, to the rights of those people who haven't any relatives to help them. So you find that a Muslim governor, according to the instructions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, a Muslim governor has the right not only to manage the affairs of his subjects, rather to show his verbal and practical sympathy to them. And then Imam Amir al-Mu'mini alayhi salam instructs Malik al-Ashtar not to ask other people to be attentive to those people who may need help. Rather, Malik al-Ashtar himself should be in charge of going to those people and having the problems solved. Another case in this connection is that when, for example, someone passes away, his survivors, his or her survivors, are grieved and are really gloomy and very sorry because of that great loss. So other people have to go to the person who has lost his or her relative and to calm him or her down and to show him or her their sympathy. Because of this, we find that in Islamic instructions and in Islamic rituals, we find that those people who experience the death or loss of one of their relatives, other people rush to them and try to calm them down and show them their sympathy and condolences.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
As it's well known, all people, everybody, may receive some mishaps in one's lifetime. And in order to maintain our sociability with other people, it's a good act of cooperation with other people and showing our mutual sympathy with others, that we express our sympathy with the bereaved people or with those people who have received the mishaps. Likewise, we are expected to do the same for other people. As if, for example, when we receive some mishaps or some problems, we may expect other people to come to our help. Likewise, other people may expect us and may expect us to help them in critical situations. The reasons for doing so can be narrowed down to the following ones. The first one is that we have mutual relations with other people, and we have shared feelings, especially when we all belong to one and the same culture or subculture. For example, in a Muslim community, we believe that helping other people, to get out of the problems, is a good act, both religiously and from a human perspective. Another kind of sympathy is that when we come in contact with other people, we find that they are recounting the problems to us. So any sympathizing person may first of all listen to his or her interlocutor's account very carefully. And then finally, we may come up with our own suggestions. It was common in the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam that he listened to other people, to other people's accounts, such that when people went to him in order to recount the problems to him, in order to find any solution or any way out of those problems or mishaps, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam first of all listened to the accounts and the report quite frankly and attentively. The third one is that people should have this kind of tolerance and not to get bored and not to get angry because of other people's accounts. Certainly, we don't like everybody in our community, and it's quite normal that some people you like, others you may not like. However, when some people come to talk with you, everybody has to show some kind of tolerance and patience in order to listen to the accounts or to the stories other people may relate for them. And these are instances of showing our sympathy with other people.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul
qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.